not just sleepwalking anymore. You understand?
I was looking up how you might define what his behavior was in that moment.
Because there are a lot of terms that are kind of similar in some ways, right? Yeah.
So there's a term called acute stress reaction, which appears in both the DSM and also in the International Classification of Diseases, but it has slightly differing definitions in each. Mm-hmm. And the one in the DSM actually applies less to this situation. So I'm going to read out the one that's from the International Classification of Diseases because it fits pretty perfectly. So acute stress reaction is defined as a transient emotional, cognitive, or behavioral change and could include inactivity, social withdrawal, stupor, and dazedness.
Okay.
So I think that's exactly it.
Stupor and dazedness, yep.
All of it.
I wondered too, when we first watched it, I wondered about describing what he was going through as like maybe a fugue state, which is something that's pretty rare, but it often involves like a loss of memory.
And he doesn't forget.
Of what you did and how you got there. A lot of times people will travel somewhere and not know how they got there. I'm at the beach, I'm at work and all this stuff, and I don't know how I got here.
It happened to Agatha Christie.
All the things. And like, I guess like, could we call it catatonia as well? Would that be fair or not so much?
I would say less so.
But the interesting thing that ties all these things together is we've kind of spoken about it before, but it's like your brain kind of noping out of a situation as a defense mechanism.
You could say dissociating.
So it is dissociating. I can't handle what's going on right now.
I'm out of here.
I'm going to remove myself, and the body's not doing it, but the brain or the consciousness is. It's really fascinating.
The mind, yeah.
The mind, and it can reduce the damage that's done at those times, mm-hmm. which is why it happens.
In traumatic situations.
Yeah, in a state of, you know, extreme stress, trauma, all these kind of things, you can have dissociation like that. And it's just a really fascinating mechanism, right? But it also plays into one of the interesting things about this family is they all seem to cope in very different ways with things and ways that are kind of separate from each other. And so Peter's always in bed. Like, he's often in bed. And then when he's dealing with this thing, he just goes right to bed, right? So obviously it's an extreme case, but I thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. So, Steve, what did you think about, like, I would call that kind of a unique way to have those scenes play out. Other movies might not have missed the chance to follow the mom as she walks out to the car.
Right.
You know, show the body, who knows. What did you think about the way that this movie handled it?
It was, I enjoyed that scene. I thought it was really, really well done. Mm. A different way of,
yes,
because you know what the mom's doing on her end of it, right?
Fair
you
enough.
Know what's going to be happening. She's going to open the door. She's going to see what's going on. She's going to be screaming. So to see the son trying to, well, hearing that and knowing, well, not knowing what's going through his head,
yeah,
what he could possibly be thinking, to just come home and just have to leave that by the wayside and figure it out in the morning. Like,
mm-hmm. Oh gosh. Imagine, eh? One of the interesting things about it is it's so hard to understand, right? Mm-hmm. How could a person act like that? Mm. So it is kind of jarring to see that, well, that's what Peter's going to do in that situation.
Yeah. You
want
to see maybe a little bit more from Peter. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Ultimately. Right.
But who knows? You guys would know better that.
Well,
how people handle things and the way that it,
the point
the trauma
is,
comes
like,
through.
Everyone handles it differently.
And there's
right?
no right way. Mm-hmm.
And so tough. Like we've talked about before, the example of a bank robbery and one person tries to attack the gunman and one person hides under the table and one person's like frozen solid. They can't get money out of the cash register for them. And like those things can all happen. And it just depends on the person,
right?
Depends on the situation, but it was painful to watch.
Yeah. That was
and then like so many shots of just Peter's eyes, his face in this movie too. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, like really hyper just on his face and him
yeah.
just being sweaty. So sweaty.
He's sweaty a lot.
He's very so sweaty.
Right. There's a point later where he ends up covered in kerosene or paint thinner in like a dream. And I, until it went to Annie, I didn't think, oh, he's covered in stuff.
Because no.
I was like, oh, he's just wet.
Yeah,
he's
par the kid's for the always course wet. For Peter.
He's always sweating. Yeah. Oh, if you had man. That much shit going on too, you'd probably be a little.
I probably would. I'd probably be sweating bullets for sure. We see them lowering a very small blue coffin of Charlie's into the
yeah,
ground
like
on a
said,
very beautiful day.
You lost some headroom.
Yeah, they got to buy the smaller coffin. It's like you being able to buy a kid-sized sleeping bag to save some money.
Yeah, and shoes.
Can you buy kids' shoes?
I can buy kids' shoes.
Nice. Wear your light-ups.
Yeah, oh, I should have some.
You should have some, or some Heelys.
Yeah. It's
currently back to school season. Got some wild light up unicorn shoes for my daughter.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
nanny took her out. She got to pick whatever she wanted.
Oh, there you go. Of course she's coming home with those.
You know it.
She's like, oh, I got some Jordans. Yeah. No, not going to happen.
Never.
Where do you think they live? Because there's beautiful mountains
behind
them.
I was meaning to look it up. Like I said last night, I'm like Colorado or something.
I could see that. I could also see like Maine.
Looks beautiful anyway. It looks like BC.
I saw where it was filmed at the end, but that has nothing to do with
it. Oh, yeah.
It was filmed in Utah.
That's mountainous. Maybe it's set there. Hereditary horror film that came to life against the backdrop of several stunning locations throughout Utah. Park City, Salt Lake City, Sandy, and Utah Film Studios.
Park City, bitch.
Park City, bitch. The Utah mountain ranges and desert landscape created the perfect backdrop for this psychological thriller.
There you go. Psychological thriller, what the fuck?
Hey. That's not a term
from
you guys
travelutah.org or whatever.
Beautiful Utah.
Exactly.
So at the funeral after party, is that what you call those?
Wake?
Yeah.
The wake. The wake is before.
The funeral after party.
Is it?
Isn't it? Isn't it the day before the funeral?
And after the party is the hotel lobby.
Yeah. After that party.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, finally nice she gets she gets a current reference and it's R. Kelly. You want to sing some P. Diddy later for us?
I think his victims get the money from the play of his songs.
Well, then we should put a clip in.
Yeah.
Jeeves.
bounce, 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 bounce.
You know what? You want to hear a funny one?
Mm-hmm.
You know, R. Kelly's a bad person. All that stuff.
We
also know that he had some good music, yep. Right? Some good songs. You know, Bump and Grind?
Mm-hmm.
When he has all that, he's like, my mind's telling me no. And he's doing all the runs and stuff. And then he gets into the like classic R&B as the song starts. I don't see nothing wrong.
Oh, I know it.
Keep going.
Our dad goes, now why would you ruin all that beautiful singing? With what comes next. So he wanted just like more runs, more riffing, more like, is it a cappella too?
I think it's just him.
And apparently dad just really loved the sultry.
Meant the sultry tones.
Yeah. So at the funeral after party is hosted at their house. I thought I probably wouldn't have made that choice. I don't think Annie's in a position.
I don't think Peter's
in a position. Like, you got all these people. Like, how must Peter be feeling about the fact that this funeral is happening?
No, and right? You want to be able to leave the thing. You don't want to have to clear everyone out.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. Poor Steve. So Steve's still running things. He's consoling Annie. He's getting the people out of the house and all that stuff. Annie has taken to sleeping in the treehouse at night.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see the windows lit up.
Well, she describes it that she can sleep there and she can't sleep in bed. It seems to me almost like wanting to be close to Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way I took it 100%. But she's putting on heaters at least. But that lights up the window with this really cool red color.
So then Peter can see that she's sleeping.
In the middle of the night. Get some scenes of Peter at school. He's glassy-eyed. He's zoning out. We ask the question, does he belong at school right now? Right? I have worked with people in a lot of tragic situations, and some of them would make the choice to go to school, and some of them wouldn't, you know? Mm-hmm. It's...
How safe is home for you? Yeah, how comforting is school for you?
And his home, definitely not a good place for him to be right now, right? Not that he's physically unsafe. He is, but he doesn't know it. But... yeah, it's like, what do you need right now? Do you need the structure or do you need time before you go back to the structure, mm-hmm. right? So
that is a really hard thing to suss out, I find. Like,
be such a hard decision to make, right?
Even as an adult, right? Like people taking a leave for bereavement or whatever. And then
right, is it going to help? Yeah.
Yeah, when do I go back? What do I do? Yeah.
He is smoking weed under the bleachers with his friends and he starts to have a reaction or thinks he is. So it's tough to know because I've seen some speculation that some of the cult are integrating some kind of weed, like not marijuana weed, but some kind of weed that has properties to help their magic along.
Some kind of herb.
And that might have been in his marijuana. But it would also be a pretty decent representation, I think, of a panic attack.
Yeah.
You know, the hyperventilating.
Pretty, pretty accurate.
Yeah, I would say. So like a panic attack, basically it starts with some kind of anxious reaction, and then you get so in your head that you're thinking about what your body's doing.
Yeah.
And you kind of, it's like a feedback loop.
And so a panic attack feels to people like a medical emergency. Uh-huh, it feels exactly. like a heart attack a lot of the time, or
yeah.
in this case, maybe like some kind of respiratory distress.
And he also says, I think my throat's getting bigger. Yeah. And another thing I find...
He says, hold my hand.
Exactly. I think that when payment is interfering a bit, I feel like the kids get infantilized. So Charlie's weird as fuck, like we've said, but she's like covering her face in chocolate as she's eating cake. And then Peter is like, please hold my hand. And his buddy very hesitantly and reluctantly does so, right? Because that's just an odd request from a 17-year-old boy to his friend. And then later, when he's at the dinner table, he's like using his fork and knife in the weirdest way. Like, it's like up and down straight and with a reverse grip on it. And you're like, what is this fucking kid doing? He looks like he's 3 years old. So, like, I wonder if there's an element to that. But the hand-holding was kind of interesting, eh?
Yeah, it was. Out of character, certainly.
I that was when I was starting to pick up on maybe the supernatural. I'm like, that he's getting payback for what? For his sister here.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. And he starts to worry about that later, that there's like a vengeful spirit after him, right? After that, he bikes home, and this scene really unsettled me, actually.
Just of Annie watching him show up, and you could see how anxious he is to enter his home.
Exactly.
Yeah, he has to, like, both of those things. Up.
He has both to psych himself things. Up just to go home. And that, what a horrible idea.
It's rough.
That'd be such a horrible feeling, right?
Just to go into your own home.
Dreading going home that bad. He's standing there, not ready to go in yet, and then he doesn't even know that Annie's in the driveway watching him from the car.
Yeah.
And looks kind of mad, like, doesn't look concerned. It's just a creepy, creepy shot. She drives off, and she drives to the support group, but she doesn't go in. But that's when she's flagged down as she goes to leave by this woman, you know.
Like preschool teacher vibes.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
And, you know, maybe in her 60s. And the woman introduces herself.
No, I just, I forgot something.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Sorry, I recognize you from a few months ago. Oh, God, I feel very silly. I'm Joan.
Says that her name's Joan, and it's really interesting because she says, well, I recognize you from before. Are you getting better after your mother? And she kind of says, oh, well, you know, my daughter died. And she says, oh, do you want to come in and talk? Do you want to just go grab a coffee? And Annie's not into it
not
at all.
Not having it at that point at all.
And then she disarms her by saying, my son and grandson died.
That was such a weird way of, like, just the way she said it was weird.
It seemed like accusatory or confrontational. My son died.
Well,
exactly.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
First, she says, my son died. And that stops Annie a little bit. And she says, how old was your daughter? And she says, 13. And she says, my son and my 7-year-old grandson drown. It's like, this woman's so wicked and she's upping the ante on her made up bullshit to try to get Annie, you know, to do what she wants. Mm-hmm. Right. So that was really just very interesting. And Annie basically says, oh, my God. And she seems completely put off by the whole encounter, but she does take her number.
Yes, she does.
Very reluctantly.
Oh, certainly. Like, she was
It was forced upon her.
Yes.
She was no easy mark. Like, she did not want to interact with this person in the least. As nice and, you know, as matronly as she seemed.
Exactly. She's like...
And she's like, oh...
She seems like incredibly lovely. She's like,
she does.
Comforting, non-threatening... older woman incarnate.
Yeah, that would like take care of you and make you a like a bowl of soup that would warm your bones.
Yep. And give you one to go home with.
Yeah, like, and give you so much food to take home. That's true. What did you think too? So there's a scene that's kind of uncomfortable for me where Steve's laying in bed and he's like reaches over and grabs Annie's shoulder. Like seemingly to connect with her in a physical way. And I just hate that kind of thing. I hate seeing someone try and get turned down, but I also thought, like, really, Steve? Like, isn't there enough happening? But, I mean, I don't know how much time is meant to have elapsed.
Are you saying that he was trying to, like, initiate sex?
I thought. That's what I thought. When I see that in a movie, that's what I think.
That's, like, cinema shorthand. Like
Chekhov's shoulder grab.
Right.
Right? It's got to mean something. But she just leaves the bed.
So I just need to sleep.
That's probably to the treehouse, I guess, right? Yeah, swing it. Try again next time, buddy. Also, one thing that we see, we get like a shot of the mail slot and someone pushes through a brochure for an open seance.
On top.
I saw that.
You know, can you imagine getting something like that through your mail? That would really
I would not
jar
be tempted.
It wouldn't tempt me, right? And then there's some weird stuff happening, like Annie's blue paint kind of tips over on its own.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because you could see that it's not the one that she could have bumped.
Exactly, and it lands on the sheet.
That says Joan.
That had Joan's number. So there's some of that stuff starting to happen, right? And then she does. She visits Joan in her apartment building. And again, Annie's making connections, but she's not looking at them all laid out.
Yeah.
You know?
The rug.
Yeah. She notices the super weird 3D like pillow doormat that is embroidered and has Joan's name on it because her mom used to make the same ones, right? Or seemingly the same ones. And she mentions that and Joan says, oh, how funny. And that's it. And that took me back to the kind of the character discussions of the Oracle where one of the students said, well, that's his problem. He's ignoring every single sign.
Right.
And so I think that Annie's subconsciously picking up on a lot of stuff, but she's not analyzing it and putting it all together. Or she's chalking it up to coincidence. Yeah. Or and like I said, that probably comes from a lifetime of this stuff.
I was going to say, it was probably like her mom gaslighting her into thinking that things were not weird.
100%.
She's a lifetime of second-guessing her instincts.
Yes, and people were acting in the background against her for her whole life.
Yeah.
So it'd be like Annie. Par for the course for
what
Annie.
What a heartbreaking way to frame
so
it, eh? Poor Annie.
Right?
It's not her fault.
Yeah.
It's her mom's fault.
Indeed. Like, this time there really is someone to blame for it. She drinks some tea and finds, like, a weird fleck in her tea.
Yeah.
Which, again, is maybe more machinations of the cult, kind of making her more susceptible, more vulnerable. With like chemicals or little ground up herbs or any of the things that they have knowledge of.
Oregano.
Could be. Joan also asks about her relationship with Peter. And that's when Annie tells the story of sleepwalking and covering her kids in paint thinner and herself and striking a match.
And she woke up to the sound of the match.
That's
being
weird, man. You don't tell that story.
Yeah, you keep that one
you
in
hold
the
that
vault.
One real.
Inside
that
thought.
You say, well, I've done some things that really creeped them out when I was sleepwalking, you know?
And then she said she really has no empathy for Peter. She has no...
I completely agree.
No compassion for Peter at all. She says, and there's nothing I could do to convince him that I was just sleepwalking.
And she says, because it happened.
Yeah, right? And like basically now he hates me is more or less how she's framing it. And it's like he is a kid.
Yeah.
And B, that is... a super concerning, terrifying experience. Mm-hmm. And you did it, whether you were awake or not. And so he has every right to feel scared and concerned about you. And that's hard. That hurts because you're his mom and you don't want your child to feel that about you. But she, I think she takes that feeling of, I don't want my son to feel that about me. And she runs with it into and changes it to he shouldn't feel that way about me and he's in the wrong for feeling that way about me.
Yeah.
And she has no empathy for his experience.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And poor Peter, he's the kid. And we've had this conversation before too, where when you have a relationship and it's with your child, the fact is you got to take the high road. You got to be the bigger person because the other person in the situation is a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like this movie is a big mental health allegory. And I almost took Annie saying that like, and I was asleep. You know, I didn't even know what I was asleep as like a situation where, you know, something happened. You really regret it happening. It was damaging to your child, but you were at a low point for some reason. And so it's difficult to kind of reconcile those two things. It's like, I was addicted or I was this or that.
Or
right?
Even I was badly depressed.
Yeah.
I was badly anxious. I was psychotic. No fault of your own. Those are illnesses, but you cannot parent effectively if you are undergoing a mental health crisis. And it's the same thing I would say in terms of like a physical illness. So if you can't get out of bed because you're seizing, you know, multiple times a day, that's a physical medical problem. But yeah, you can't parent effectively. It's the same. But the difference is that people, because it's not a visible thing, like a broken leg or a person seizing in front of you, it's not visible in the same way. People view it as a choice and it's not as simple as that.
And they don't give it the understanding that it's due, right? I think I agree. She downplays how traumatic it would have been for Peter. It's like, you were asleep, but I woke up covered in a solvent with you about to light me on fire.
Yeah.
Let's just call it.
You didn't, but you were about to.
Right?
That's a long road back.
Oh, yeah. How do you? And with no, give from your mom,
right.
you're not
yeah,
getting
for her
that.
Being like, enough about that.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Enough about that.
How long are you going to hold that one against
me? I didn't
me?
Light you.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. On I and on. Did I drop the match?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, please call me when your fake burns heal. Yeah. Like, you're not, you were fine. But then also, again, so this is a situation where it's like, okay, Annie seems unpredictable and she seems like her mental health might not always be so good. And she acts out in ways that are dangerous. But I think that again, subconsciously, she's trying to save her family from what's going to happen. Right. Like Peter.
She's trying to like family annihilation.
Yeah. But they're all going to hell. Right. And
even
she's trying
Steve?
To, she's trying to spare them that.
Even Steve. Cause he's even all, Steve. He's wrapped up in it.
Yeah.
And Peter is his child.
Guilt by association.
Yeah. Because of the workings of the cult, they're all in this plot, and she doesn't realize, but she's trying to save them from it. Peter's going upstairs at home. Dad says, hey, did you sign up for that SAT prep course? So again, in my head, I was like, why, Steve?
Dude, not the time.
Yeah, like, you know what? His sister just died. Maybe he's not going to college next year.
Exactly. But then again, I'm thinking, okay, Steve only understands things by... I've got to put things in order and I need my family back where they're meant to be. I need them doing the things they're meant to do. And he's trying to find some semblance of,
you are 17 years old. You should take your SATs.
Time.
Yeah.
100%. Still trying to instill some order, I think. And order isn't always inherently good, right? There are parts of life that are, you know, you can't really enforce that kind of order into. And maybe he is trying to do a good thing, but I was just thinking, like, how can you expect him to do that right now? Right? Like, I thought that was so unrealistic. Ooh, another scene that really bothered me. After he's made dinner, Steve comes upstairs, and Annie is working on a diorama of Charlie's death. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, like, what did you think about that, Steve? Because that really bothered me.
Yeah, that was the... one of the first, it's like, okay, so mom's really, Annie's not doing well. Like she's spiraling here.
Also, I almost took it in kind of a selfish way.
Like, what do you, like, why would you want to?
Selfish, yeah.
Why right? would you want to relive, redo any part of that?
Yeah, yeah. And she's obtuse as well. He's like, how could
incredibly
you make
this? Obtuse and tone deaf.
What if Peter saw it? And she's like, what? It's just a neutral view of the accident. Why would he even care? She's either so naive or she's being intentionally obtuse. Like,
she has to be.
So silly. And then not to mention, that's his daughter that died. And now he's staring, he's confronted by it.
There's too many emotions around him that he's trying to mediate that he's not feeling his own.
You're exactly right. I really feel that way. Like he had no space in that family, basically.
No, and it's his child just died just as much as hers and just as much as it was Peter's sister, and he doesn't get a chance to experience his own feelings.
No, he's not allowed to have anything. He still has to try to be the one.
He's got
to
keep everyone calm. He's got to keep everyone, you know, sated and...
Yeah, Annie is pretty despicable in this scene.
Honestly, I was so unnerved. Like, I would want to knock her block off.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, I'd be like, I got to get the hell out of here.
I don't want this in my house.
Yeah.
I don't want to see it.
No.
You know? And
I'd smash it to smithereens, I think.
And she clearly has a very narrative coping style.
Yeah.
She's a storyteller. The way she processes things is to lay them out like that. So she clearly gets a catharsis by making them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she feels like she's able to put order to things.
It's like we've discussed before of like a trauma narrative, right?
Yep.
Talk it through from the beginning to the end and go through every part until it doesn't hurt you anymore.
Yes. And imagine spending hours meticulously crafting the death scene of your daughter.
That's a lot of time you're spending with it.
Right? You'd have to sit in that. And maybe you come out with a little more comfort, I suppose. But it's not fair to do it when there are other people involved.
No, she's not thinking. She definitely doesn't think about Steve.
God, no.
Doesn't think about his emotions.
And Steve finally shows some cracks, too. He's like,
I don't fucking care or whatever.
Yeah. He's like, I'm here to get you for dinner. And she says, I'm making dinner. He's like, I already made dinner.
Yeah.
I'm here to get you and you can come or not. I don't care. And it's like, fair enough. Steve.
And even the idea of him saying, I'm coming to get you for dinner, I'm making it, is like her taking away the fact that he did that work. It's like, no, fuck you, I already did.
Yeah, it's made, actually.
Yeah.
And he's got such a balance to try to strike, and I think it would be an impossible one. You need to support your wife. She needs it. You also have children to protect, and one is kind of eclipsing the other. Mm. He's trying to do both. They're both impeding on each other.
Mm-hmm. You know? And they're at loggerheads. Annie and Peter.
Oh, yeah.
So then how do you mediate that? because you owe something to both of them. But as I would always say, you arguably owe more to the child.
And his daughter's dead.
And his daughter. Well, yeah. And no his, time for that.
And his beloved mother-in-law.
Yes. Yeah.
With the big huge tits. Fan of.
Where he's like, hey, Peter, pretty funny that she's dead, right? Hey, buddy. Okay. We get to another absolutely famous scene in this movie. I'm going to have Jenna describe it, but Steve, tell us your experience of watching the dinner scene.
Is this a dinner table you'd want to be sat at?
Ooh, yeah, this is a hard one.
Right? On the one hand, the food looks good.
Yeah. And Peter does confirm it is.
Yeah, Peter said that did a good job. He almost said it like to the mom, like, wow, Dad, this is really good. Like making sure that the mom.
Interesting. Realized.
That was bad because the whole time I wanted something between Annie and Peter about Charlie's death. Like
yeah, they didn't come out.
They didn't give you anything. Like there was nothing from the mom saying towards the son to the mom.
Good point. And I don't think they left it out. I think it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Like there had been nothing at that point, but you want some sort of reaction. Like
exactly.
You know, there's so much just below the surface mm-hmm. oh, ready to come out. Yeah. And then finally, they erupt at each other.
Yeah.
And it's painful.
So what was your feeling watching that? Just like, you know, pain, emotional pain?
Yeah.
That's the way I take it too. It's that was like hard to watch.
Yeah, it was. That was like a bad couple's quarrel where like you're saying shit that you're like, oh, that one's
can't
already
take,
said.
Can't put that one back in the
that
bag.
That one's been said already.
You and can like, say, you know, I'm sorry 10 times, but it's never going to all go away.
No.
Yeah, you can't take it back.
And like between like the mom and son, that bond that now you're.
Yeah.
Like, in a, yeah.
Yeah. So for our listeners, Jenna, do you want to kind of describe it? Some of the beats of it?
So they're all around the dinner table and Steve and Peter seem to be trying to make it work. Annie has a very surly expression on her face.
She's like flouncing around. She's like, whoa.
She's huffing and puffing and smirking and being extremely petulant, if anything.
Indeed,
she's acting like a child. And it's almost like Peter and Steve are the parents trying to make it work and make nice, basically. And Peter says to Steve that, oh, dinner's good, Dad. And
thanks, buddy.
And he says, thanks, buddy. And with a smile, like a moment of like probably much needed connection, surface level though it may be.
And Annie mocks that.
And she's Annie,
like, thanks, Vinny.
Yeah, instantly scoffs at it, mocks it. And and then Peter feels it and he feels it from his mom all the time. And so then he feels like he needs to break the tension. And so he confronts her outright just to make it happen.
Exactly.
And
he pushes it.
Which is... That's something that people do, right? Like
she's resistant.
In abusive relationships, people will do that because they can't live with the tension anymore.
Okay.
So it's a relief of the tension just to have that confrontation happen and out in the open.
Just seems like there might be something you want to say.
Peter.
Like what? I mean, why would I want to say something so I could watch you sneer at me?
So interesting you mentioned that too, because at one point, he says, well, maybe it would be a release to talk about it. And she's like, what, like release you? And he says, release me.
Yeah, fine, release me. Right. Yeah, release me from my torment. Tell me how you really feel so that I'm not just imagining it myself.
Yeah.
She stands up from the table.
Oh, yeah.
She's yelling. She's shouting at him. It's an incredible performance from Toni Collette.
It is.
Oscar snub performance.
I think it was Churchill that won that year?
Maybe.
So we'll have to find out.
So it's Gary Oldman wearing 10 feet deep of makeup.
That hack.
Yeah. Saying, we'll fight on the beaches and we'll fight yada, 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 Churchill. We get it.
We all know the story.
Yeah, keep calm and carry on. We get it. Meanwhile, Annie's going, I am your mother. And she says some things, but she does. She misses the mark always because she says some things that would be okay and could be framed okay. Like she says, I know you miss her. I know you're hurting.
Yes.
I wish I could take your pain away.
Yes.
I think all of those things are really good messages.
Even her saying, all I do is worry and slave. Yeah. It's like, oh, mom worries about me.
Exactly. It's like that would be a good thing to express. And
you're right.
I think that if it's framed right and done in a completely different way, obviously, to say, I know you're hurting. I know I want to take your pain away, but your sister's dead. I think that would be okay because it's a way to say like, I know those things. I know I'm your mom, but also my child's dead. Your sister's dead. I also need to deal with that.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's like she just can't get it right. And this is a moment where she's extremely emotionally escalated. Yes. So she's not going to get it right.
Yes.
And so she says some things that are just very inappropriate to Peter and yes. hurts him deeply, wounds him deeply. And you can see that. And then he wants to hurt her back. And then he turns it around on her and implies that it's her fault.
He does say one thing. Because otherwise, he was pretty measured, I think.
And he says, why was she even at the party, Mom? She didn't even want to go. So saying it's your fault for having her go
you
to the party.
You should have known she'd die in an anaphylactic
which, of course,
beheading.
is a reach, right?
they're both reaching.
I didn't feel like that one was as bad of a reach when he called the mom out. Because she was screaming about how no one accepts
what they've done.
And it's like, all right, we want to accept what we've done. You fucking forced her to come to the party. So let's start right at the very beginning.
Exactly.
That's how I saw that one. It's like, okay, you want
to
go back?
And Peter's got good gripes. I mean, mom has been treating it's so hard to say, right? Because how are you supposed to act? The family's going through the worst thing imaginable, but Peter's being put through a lot of pain by what's going on, right?
But, do you know what I don't like that Steve doesn't interrupt her.
I can see where he's coming from, but he needed to do something, yeah.
But I do like that when he finally says to her, enough, she goes, fine, and she leaves.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
I do kind of like that they seem to have at least a certain amount of mutual respect between them, that she doesn't come back at him and attack him. She does leave.
You know,
I think that was actually kind of good.
I think so, too. And he does say, that's enough. We're done.
She says, fine, and doesn't give him a rejoinder. She just leaves.
He might have thought maybe some of this needs to happen, you know?
The tension did need to break.
Yes.
Yeah. But one of the interesting things, and this goes, you know, whether it comes down to the writing, whether it comes down to some of Toni Collette as well, I don't know, like, what exactly was written on the page, but there's some interesting things, right? She says, all you do is sneer at me.
She sneers at him all the time.
And he says, I don't sneer at you. And she says, well, you don't need to. You get your point across. So it's like, well, what are you talking about?
What's that supposed to mean?
And all I get is that fucking face on your face. Like, she's not making sense, right? She's so out of it. She's so mad.
That fucking face on your face.
That she can't make sense. But it's like, so is he sneering or not? What are you trying to say? So there's so much resentment building up. And the family's not communicating. And those are like two toxic things really playing out against everyone. So Annie clearly more than resents Peter. And that's a really tough thing to reconcile and to deal with.
Your child, I can't even imagine.
Hard to imagine. But like we said, they've been through one of the worst things anyone could imagine. Nobody admits what they've done. And I think that's so interesting when you consider Annie's context of being manipulated from the time that she was born and having a sense that something's not right. And it's like, but no one's admitting it.
Would you say that she is projecting?
I believe she certainly is projecting. Yeah, because Peter's not the one, you know, doing...
Who's been doing it to
He's
her.
Not orchestrating it. She doesn't know any of this, but at some level she does.
And she also doesn't have an outlet for the real kind of font of her anger, which is her mom.
True.
Her mom's dead.
Her mom's
gone.
She
can't.
That's true. And she knows her mom was to blame for some things, but she can't really pin it down. But now she's gone. So you're quite right about that. So I really agree.
And on her poor little son.
I know. So yeah, I thought that was a holdover from her experience with her own family of just constantly being gaslit from the time that she was born to the time that she's in her 40s. Like, unrelentingly, right?
Yeah.
And also after she leaves, because she's asked to. And Steve kind of puts his hand on.
Yeah, I think he needed a bit more, but that's good.
Exactly. Like they still stay silent.
I'm glad he made the physical contact. He reached across, but he probably could have done with a hug.
You know, like maybe
a little kiss.
Maybe Steve isn't a counseling psychiatrist. You know, maybe he's more on the like.
Maybe he's a researcher.
Yeah. But I just thought like, you got to say something, man. You got to say something. Right. Like, look what just happened. And you're like, pat, pat, pat. You know, he's like kind of stiff upper lip. You know, he's
British,
like stoic. Yeah, right. Annie is going to a craft store. Kind of looks like a Michaels.
I know, which seems funny. Like, seems like she should be special ordering her fancy materials.
Maybe she gets some stuff there.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, she gets the raw materials and makes them.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe
she's getting like clay.
And she sees Joan in the parking lot.
Oy,
interestingly, it seems like Joan's bags are full of chalkboards. And stuff like that. And Joan, again, like, oh, Annie.
Oh, yes.
Running across the parking lot.
That was a bit unnerving.
Is that when you started to maybe suspect Joan a bit?
Why are you so exuberant, like, that was a lot.
Expressive, animated.
It was a lot. And then we really noticed too, and we were talking about it. She's saying, "Oh, Annie, I feel completely turned around. I went to a seance, and, you know," and like Annie's trying to check out.
Yeah. Right?
And every time Annie tries to check out,
she's like smirking, looking away.
She's trying to get away.
And every time she does that, Joan grabs her. And it's like, she animated. Grabs
her and reorients her body back towards her, like, 8 times.
It's really incredible, and it looks natural.
If a person you can were touching me that much, and as we've just said, I'm a relatively touchy person. If a person was touching me that much, I'd be like, this is a lot.
Or you just stop moving away from them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you just wait it out.
Maybe I just tune in. Be like, okay, this is what you need from me.
Yeah, and she says, you know, there was a... It's funny, right?
There was a neurologist there.
Some of the trigger words she's using. There was a skeptical neurologist there. And he was forever changed. Like, oh, yes, hello, I'm a neurologist. Honestly, I don't believe in this type of thing, but here I am.
That would make me roll my eyes harder than almost anything that she said.
Like, can you imagine a more cliche?
There was a skeptical neurologist there. I'm like, you know what? A lot of doctors are just as stupid as anyone else.
Hey, you heard it here
Everyone's got their blind spots.
Sorry,
you know?
Doctors. But it's played out really well. Joan is kind of so affected in the way that she's trying to just engage Annie, and it's done so well.
Sinking her claws in.
Not for nothing, but they're standing beside either a Chevy Avalanche was my guess, or a Honda Ridgeline.
I was going Honda Ridgeline, yeah.
Well, you're the professional, so I'm going to go with that.
I thought it was the sexy 45 degree angles of the Chevy Avalanche, but I guess, how long have those been out of production? 10 years more?
Yeah, I'd say at least 10, probably.
Probably was a Ridgeline. So Joan is like, what are you doing right now? Come over to my house right now. Right? So things are really ramping up for Joan, for the coven she's a part of, the cult. They're like really ramping things up and trying to like get the hooks fully in Annie.
But she still went.
Yes.
She
did. So she goes back to her apartment.
She's vulnerable, right?
She definitely. So she goes back to her apartment. And what brings her there is saying that they can connect to
a person who's passed on.
To Charlie.
Yes.
And so she brings her back to the apartment, shows her how to perform this seance, which she had to say a certain amount of mumbo jumbo first.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, the two of them place their hands very gently on a glass, an upturned glass.
Yeah.
And yeah, the idea being that neither of them move it, but they have to be in contact with it. And she's speaking to her grandson, whose name is Louis, and asking him to demonstrate that he's there.
Yes.
Annie does get the sensation that the glass is moving. She's like, oh, she's getting like disconcerted. She's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Kind of childlike.
She's getting
very scared.
Oh yeah. And she's like very fidgety.
Of course. Of course. That would be one of the most, that would be one of the most scary situations I could have. If something happened to me to make me believe in the supernatural, I would be like, oh no, my whole paradigm is gone.
Paradigm shift for sure. And then, so she's connecting to Louis, and then she connects to him through a chalkboard.
Yes.
Which she then has him write on, and he says, I love you, Grammy.
And she's like, oh, Louis.
Oh, Louis, I love you too, baby.
And she's asking him questions that any parent would want the answers to.
Yes.
Are you okay? Are you in pain? Like, the screws being twisted on Annie are just unbelievable, right? It's like,
are you okay?
They're going right for the soft spots on poor Annie. So, Steve, what did you think? Like, did you find the seance a scary scene?
Yeah.
It's very scary for Annie. Did you find it scary as
well? Oh, yeah. Like, as you listeners may know, I've always been heavily creeped out.
I'm easily scared.
Yeah. Like, Ouija boards back in the day did it for, like, I've been out on that.
You left the party?
I certainly was not hitting the Ouija board. That was not for me. No, it was very creepy. It was very off-putting, especially seeing, like, once the glass moved the first time, seeing Annie's face, like you said, completely changed to, like, oh, shit, okay, whoa. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
she's freaked
right
out.
That was too much for her to take in at that point.
Yeah, it's written all over her face. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's it. That's Toni Collette's whole performance.
That
she
is
does
her...
an amazing line at shock and terror without saying anything.
Yes.
Like, her mouth opens so big, I'm like, how the hell?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
She's, like, just an all-around performer. Like, every bit of her is channeling what her character is feeling. I feel like she's extremely good at that.
Yeah, I'm very moved by everything she does in this movie.
Yeah, like,
and
I said,
I think
she's a great actress.
Hanging on every word, you know, she's got me.
And going into Joan's apartment was very, like, it looked so much different than the first time we saw the apartment.
Yep.
Like the second time after she started doing the seances, it's all very.
Yeah, it looked super normal at first.
Yeah, it did.
Absolutely, it did.
The first time visiting.
She had blankets up all over everything. Like a lot of stuff was covered. Mm. There were dozens and dozens of candles all over the place.
Yes. Like, she's very witchy.
Replacing the natural light
a witchy woman.
She is a witchy woman. She basically, Annie rushes out of there. She's had enough.
Yeah.
Right? And she's like, stop it. And Joan is like, what?
I know. She looks like offended.
And, you know, Annie rushes out of there, but not before Joan says, here's this pamphlet. You say these words. I don't know what language it is. You light a candle. Make sure every member of your household is in the house. So it's like they have to do some ritual to kind of open things up. And all the family needs to be there. So she thinks she's going to contact Charlie. What she's really going to do is just like move along the cult's plan with some invocation, right?
Yeah, she's going to invite Payman directly into the house.
Yeah, or something, or into all the family, right? Like
take your pick of the family really members. Cool.
Yeah, they're really setting her up, man.
Oh, isn't it amazing? And from 100 miles away and we don't see it.
No.
So she teaches her how to do the spell, basically, and we get a lot of quick cutting.
She must say the right words.
Yeah, we get a lot of quick cutting. See, that's what Joan says to her cult buddies. And we get a lot of quick scenes, but this is one of the ones that got us, right? That we took note of, where Annie is sleeping or trying to sleep, and then she follows the line of ants all the way down her hallway. She sees them crawling on Peter, then she sees them like completely covering her face. And we saw a scene like
they did with Charlie's face.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right.
Her decapitated head.
You're right. You're right. So not her face, but his face. Exactly, right? And they're like, I don't know. Some people have trouble with swarming things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like they really hate the sight of that. So
I
that would be a tough
one. Probably like an evolutionary thing.
Same.
Because a swarm is a bad thing.
Can't be good. And where you find bugs, you find bad things. Where you find a billion
bugs.
You
find rot. Yeah, you find decay, things that'll make you sick. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was one time we were going to go on a trip.
This is my fault.
My eldest was about two or three, probably two. And basically, we were going to go on this road trip, and my eldest really wanted to grab her backpack. So he said, okay, go into the house and get it. We're like literally in the car ready to go. And she comes back and she's like, Mom, there's 1,000 bugs in my room.
There's 1,000 bugs in my closet.
And so we go and we look in her backpack, and she had gone to on a trip with Jenna and her husband the week before, or maybe longer. Dear. And there was a banana in her backpack.
Oh, liquid.
An old banana.
Oh, it was brutal. And so there were bugs everywhere. We're like, damn it. But it's like,
I just throw the backpack outside and go,
Mom, there's 1,000 bugs in my room.
Yeah, it's like, what? That's something you got to investigate.
Yeah, like, okay, let's go check that one out.
Yeah, we're going to look into that one.
So she does. She sees these ants completely covering her son.
And his mouth opens and like the big ball of them comes out.
Yeah. And she's completely horrified. She's doing more of her incredible face acting. And the vision snaps away as Peter's asking, Mom, what are you doing in my room?
We can see her standing there at the end of the bed. She's been sleepwalking.
And he's fine. No ants.
He's fine. He's normal, but talking to her.
And he says, Mom, you're sleepwalking. And she's all confused. Where's Charlie? And he's like, what? What are you talking about? And eventually he kind of starts to confront her again. He says, why are you scared of me?
She says, I never wanted to be your mother. And then she instantly claps her hand over her face, knowing that that is the thing she can't take back. And she goes on to describe, I didn't.
She keeps going.
I didn't
she felt
feel
forced.
Like, she kind of qualifies it in a way that might make you feel a bit better, but then it doesn't. Like I say, she never sticks the landing. She never sticks the landing. She says, I didn't feel like a mother. And that's something that you could explain to your child, especially your 17-year-old child, in a way that would could be okay.
Right.
Like
I didn't feel ready.
I didn't feel ready at the time.
Yeah.
And she does go on to say, I love you. I love you so much.
She does also tell him that she tried every trick in the book to abort him.
Right.
Yep.
Right. To miscarry him.
Then why did you have me?
It wasn't my fault. I tried to stop it.
How?
I tried to have a miscarriage.
Although and just he's like, doing
you tried to kill me.
What she says is, I did everything they told you not to do.
Jumping so on trampolines.
Like, I was jumping on trampolines.
Eating spicy food.
I was eating seafood. I was eating deli meat. I was smoking crack. I was drinking. It's like she could have been doing the things that you're not supposed to do is a hilarious thought because there are so many things and they're so. She's like, I was doing ab exercises. I was, you know what I mean? Like there are just so many things.
And you're still here.
And you still made it. But, and then this is obviously extremely distressing to
him.
Yeah,
like the rejection of the son by the mother would be like complete at that point. You know what I mean? Like that would be a blow that you couldn't get
over, I
think.
And then she also said, I was trying to save you.
So again, her subconscious working towards something good.
Be here.
But everyone's like, how could she do this? How could she say this? Right?
Well, sure, but the saving is death, though.
Of course, yeah. But it seems like that's the best they could have got.
Yeah.
Everything's inevitable.
I was trying to save you.
Everything's inevitable for this family, right? Yep. But yeah, really interesting kind of doublespeak. And this is the scene where it goes back and forth, and then suddenly they're both covered in paint thinner.
And they're both covered in paint thinner, and then it's a double wake-up. It was a double dream.
Double dream. You never see the double dream coming.
Oh, yeah. Nope, I certainly did not see the double dream coming.
Oh, wait, what's that famous movie that does the double dream?
Werewolf in London.
American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
Inception?
Yeah, Inception does like a... You couldn't even count.
Inception.
Yeah, so he got hit with the classic double dream, never see it coming. Then she really does go to Peter's room, wakes him up.
Right, she
gets
wakes
right in his face.
She's like laying atop of him.
He must have been
terrified.
And says,
it's okay, it's me. It's like, okay, well, that's still not okay.
Currently not okay.
Not a ringing endorsement.
Brings him down to the main floor.
And
also
wakes Steve as
does
well.
The same with Steve. The windows in the house are all open.
Yep.
Steve goes to close it. She says, no, it all has to be like this because it was like this when I conjured Charlie. So she were led to believe that she, while they were sleeping, she was awake. She did it. It worked. She did the seance herself. She says, I'm a medium, Steve. Yes. I can do it. She's trying to convince him. Steve is so
done.
He's fighting with every inch. Yep. He does not.
He's angry.
He's mad. He does not want to engage with her about this, but she's so desperate and he's like against his better judgment and through gritted teeth, he's kind of allowing himself to go along with her, but he does not want to.
And she says, I'm lucid.
Yeah.
Do you think that this could be like, could characterize like a manic or delusional episode? Like, do you think it would have some of the hallmarks he might be looking for?
So like this isolated incident, you couldn't call mania.
Oh, right, sure.
Not this one isolated incident, but if, say, this is all the information that I had, and this is all the information that I had, and Steve came to me and said, I'm concerned about my wife. Mm-hmm. She was up all night, not sleeping. She woke us up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
She had been busy performing an activity. She was talking a mile a minute.
Yeah.
Her emotions were heightened. Those are all symptoms.
She has pretty grand ideas.
Those
too.
Are all symptoms of mania.
Right.
Yep. The idea that she has a special power or ability that others don't.
That
I'm a medium.
She discovered, she stumbled onto and discovered it.
That is literally the phrasing that I use in assessments. I say, do you ever feel that you have a special power or ability that other people don't? And when the answer is no, which it often is, because it's part of my general admission assessment, then my funny rejoinder is always like, might be nice, right? Like, if we did.
We have fun.
We have fun here on the psych unit. But yes,
you'll get used to me.
If you told me. So if he called, say, the crisis line and said, I'm concerned about my wife. This is what I'm seeing.
You'd be like, then that maybe would send her in.
That would be in my head. Maybe she's manic. Maybe she's having a manic episode. But mania happens over the course of like at least a week. So if she only did this for one night, then it wouldn't be.
Gotcha. So if you guys observed her and she wasn't acting like that anymore and you knew it had been isolated to just that night, then it wouldn't qualify.
I wouldn't call it mania it wouldn't make me suspect bipolar disorder.
Sure, sure. Okay. So she starts the seance. The glass moves. Peter says he can feel the air flexing.
Oh, and that's the other thing I wanted to say too.
Flame goes crazy.
Was that although Steve was super resistant, Peter, we said that night.
Let's give it a try.
Like he was extending an olive branch to his mom.
I completely agree with you. Yeah. He was trying to smooth things out a bit.
Yeah, which shouldn't be the kid doing it.
Especially when mom's like, I can conjure spirits and I'm a medium and we need to do... Like, I'd be like, oh, jeez.
Sure,
much.
Mom.
So again, Steve is like, well, I don't know about this, but it's like, it's not enough, Steve. Like, get him out of the house. Get her out of the house. Come on.
Yep. Like, Peter, we're going well. Right now.
Yeah. Like, unfortunately, your mother is dealing with something. A little something.
Mom's your mother is overtired. The deep end.
And the seance happens. There is evidence that someone's there, a spirit's there. A glass breaks on the cabinet. The flame shoots up in the air.
Out of the candle, yeah.
And Peter is completely terrified.
And he's
infantilized
crying.
Again.
Yeah.
And like,
oh, I know. You know? Is that an acting misstep or intentional?
Or is he meant to seem
a kind of weird and off?
Weird or a little bit childish or
to seem fake to me.
You didn't seem real.
No one cries
crying,
like that.
Fake crying's hard.
And I mean, wait, kids fake cry.
There's, I don't know. I've
kids are good
never
at
had
it.
Like a full ugly cry.
Oh, I have, but it doesn't sound like that.
I cry exceedingly rarely, but I think I've had some ugly cries for sure.
Yeah, rad guys don't cry.
No, I'm rad. We established that earlier, right?
Rad to the bone.
Too rad to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
Got that emblazoned on a skateboard.
And in your skin.
Yeah, tattoo.
Yeah, he's terrified. He's fully bought it. And she's channeling at times Charlie's voice.
Charlie,
at times
speaking
it's her
like
own
a little girl.
Voice.
Yep.
Saying like, Mom.
Mommy.
Yeah.
That What's was, happening?
Yeah.
Hello?
Mom?
Mom?
I don't like this. Dad, I don't like this.
What's happening?
Please stop.
That was really, that was when Steve super lost.
That put you, Steve, on edge?
And then Steve douses her in
water. And she snaps out of it.
And she goes, what?
Yeah, like so full offended. Mean girl.
Classic Annie, gotta be indignant, right? She's like, why would you do that,
indignant
Steve?
Indeed.
What's your fucking problem? Thought you were a psychiatrist. Yeah, so like things start happening a mile a minute at this point, right?
Things unfold very fast.
So Peter's in class. He sees the flying blue light.
Yep.
Okay. He sees an image of himself sneering in the window beside him.
That was very, very, that was unsettling.
Yeah. Even out loud, we're like, that's a sneer.
Yeah. That, yeah.
So you found that a little tricky to watch, Steve?
Yeah, that was very strange. Because you know this kid, like, he's really in the midst of some stuff. Like, 100%. He's not mentally well. Physically now, he's not well. He's seeing things, like.
The noose is tight.
Oh, man.
You know what it reminds me of? Like certain scenes I just find physically hard to watch. Some of the scenes with Samara's dad, great actor.
Brian Cox.
Yeah, I find him so scary when he's up in the window looking down when he discovers her in the house. But also in The Babadook when she's watching that news spot about a woman who killed her kid. And then she's like in the bottom corner of the window, like smiling out the window. I'm like, get it off the screen.
Weird.
And Peter's sneering
about his
is
face?
One of them.
About his stupid fucking face on his face?
On his face, exactly.
Face on my face.
So he jumps up and excuses himself to the bathroom, and he receives a call from Steve saying he's hysterical at school. He thinks there's a spirit after him. He's terrified, and he says, Annie, I have a son to protect. And I'm like, fucking bingo, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's gone on long enough. Don't bring him home. But that's what happens, and he hangs up on Annie, and she gets really furious.
And she calls him back to say, don't hang up on me.
Don't you ever hang up on me. And it kind of reminds me of the conversation she had with Peter earlier. I am your mother. You don't ever raise your voice to me, mm-hmm. right? But one thing that she does scream at him is, I'm not sleepwalking anymore. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's like she's noticing things now. All these bad things have happened when she was sleepwalking. She wasn't paying attention. She was, you know, her subconscious picked up on some things, but she wasn't putting it together. Now she's alert to there's some fucking shit going on, and I can tell. I'm not sleepwalking anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I mean? So I was like, damn,
this is real.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. She's not missing the signs anymore, the fact that something bad is happening. Also, she seems to be implying that she makes her mistakes when she's sleepwalking. And it's like, is there a little naivete there, maybe?
Or
like,
a little bit of like deflection, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Not
just
taking,
not ready
not taking
to own
ownership.
It. Yeah. Not ready to own it. Just like she accused other people of doing. She destroys all of her dioramas.
Oh, that's a hard one.
Right? You know how long she toiled on them. You knew that there was a little bit of pressure coming from the art gallery. You know, she had little stickies to keep working, to remind herself to keep working, and she destroys them all. Obviously, that's a release catharsis thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read into it in any other way?
Blowing her life up, I guess.
Yeah, self-sabotage.
Yeah.
Kind of her last, one of the last things she still had going in the right direction.
Do you know what I literally thought to myself, though? I'm like, there's probably, I would still send it to the gallery and be like, oh, here's an interesting take. in the midst of my
here's what happened
depression.
To the, here's what happened to the miniature artist during this time.
Yeah.
Here was the result.
Here's the result. I'd be like, okay, I feel like you could salvage that.
Haute couture.
And honestly,
then.
That would be a cooler exhibit. You'd be like, oh, wow.
Yeah, she really lost her mind.
The drama.
I guess I get it. You know?
Yeah.
And I wondered if it was kind of just like rebelling. She had been trying to control things. She'd been trying to explain things. And she's like, it's not working. It's got me nowhere. I'm just rebelling against this. And she wants control, but she's got none. And that's the whole point of this whole movie. No one had control over anything.
Yeah, because the miniatures, that's what it really felt like. It's like, okay, this is me, my world.
Yeah,
I control
exactly.
Everything.
And meanwhile, like we said, if that's you true. Zoom out, they're the ones in a dollhouse being kind of manipulated the whole time, which is kind of neat.
Fully articulated limbs.
Yes, yes, with real crying and peeing action.
Yes, yes.
And Steve also comes home. He's like, what the fuck happened here? He sees all the destroyed...
I didn't want to look at it anymore.
Yep. And he also sees that the little figure of Peter in bed has been decapitated. His kappa was detated
from his body.
He's we see scenes where Steve's trying to go to bed on the couch. He's taking, obviously, more than his prescribed pills.
Takes three.
Yeah, instead of two, right?
So does that mean you sleep longer, or you're just really...
If they are
out.
Indeed sleeping pills.
Yeah, like, it wouldn't be a sure thing of anything. And it might not even be that much more. Like, depending on what the dose is and stuff, he might still wake up at a relatively normal time the next day and just feel a bit groggy.
Okay.
So a whole bunch of stuff happens. Peter wakes up, sees Charlie in his room. Her head rolls off, turns into a ball.
Yeah.
The dog is barking at the threshold of his room, and then the door slams.
And the
in
dog's
his face.
Eyes were all weird too. Did
yeah,
you see
it,
that?
It looked mad.
Yeah, it looked pretty like, fucked up. Yeah. Right. Also, someone tries to pull off Peter's head, so he's laying in bed. We see arms reach out and grab him under the chin and yank.
But do you think maybe it's a cultist?
I honestly wondered if it's just a cultist hidden in his room.
Because they are in the house.
They're constantly going through the house hidden.
And
I thought it was the mom.
Well, and then all of a sudden Annie's in his room and she says, that wasn't me. I'd never do that to you.
But,
and
she
doesn't believe
her. She says, I heard you screaming and I came in.
Yeah, exactly.
But we don't actually know.
Right.
Because he's scared of her, right? And he was like, you tried to pull my head off.
Also, like, how would you even do that?
Also, if someone yanked on my head, I wouldn't probably think they were trying to pull off my head.
It feels great. You get like a nice little crack every once in a while.
I do see a lot of like videos of chiropractors really yanking on people's heads with towels and stuff.
Yikers.
So the cultists are in the house too.
No,
they have to be.
The cultists are going through the house, I think, all the time. Like that, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening that they're doing and people aren't noticing them.
Is that why they have to take their shoes off? Because there's always a mess in the house?
Yeah. So I think that there are scenes where you can see muddy footprints all over the house. And that is part of what's driving Steve up the wall, I think.
Someone's
like,
not taking
I
their
told
shoes
you
off.
Guys, take your shoes off. Take your socks off if they're dirty, like all this stuff. And really, it's just these weird naked cult people.
Naked grandma. Yeah.
Naked grandma. And they are pretty much naked grandmas. Also, Annie has found this book that it was Charlie's notebook, and it's being filled with pictures of dead Peter, right? With his eyes crossed out, and she's disturbed by that. She tries to throw it in the fire, and her arm catches fire.
Takes it out, stomps it out.
And she thinks, if I burn this book, then I burn too. Mm-hmm. That's the connection that she makes, right? She tries to go back to Jones, I think, to figure out what's going on.
Yep. And
that's
Joni
a really cool
is not
scene.
Home, but we get a peek into her apartment.
She's
and we...
knock, 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 knocking on the window.
She's trying to break in.
Knock, yes. Knock, knocking on Joni's door.
And as it zooms out, we see, like you said earlier, Steve, furniture's covered in white cloth. There are candles everywhere.
Several homunculi.
Several. And they're all made by Charlie.
Yeah.
And they're in like a worshiping position, like a downward dog thing around a triangle that's
which
carved into
seen.
The table.
Yeah.
And that has Peter's picture in
yes.
it.
Yes.
So it's like, that's the point, surely, where you're like, oh.
Everything is connected. See, it all connects.
Yeah. We see that same symbol that was on the necklaces. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a really cool shot.
On the pole that...
It was on the pole that Charlie ran into as well. Mm-hmm. It was even like on Charlie's bed frame. I'm pretty sure it was like the designs of her bed frame. It's really cool. It's like the wallpaper kind of looks the same too. Very interesting. But that is where we get the scene, Jenna, that you were talking about at Peter's school with Joan.
Yeah, it's poor Peter sitting all alone eating his, well, not eating his lunch, just sitting in front of him. And across the way, like across the road from his school. And so he shouldn't even be able to hear her as clearly as he does.
Yeah.
But it's because she's you know,
she's projecting, conjuring she's spells. Got what's it called, thaumaturgy.
Yes, she is saying, "I, Peter, I cast you out of his own body," and she's using some of those words we saw written
Satiny.
Down.
I expel you. The Paragon! Peter! Get out!
Yeah, poor guy. Getting cast out of his own body.
Yeah. Yeah, you hate to see it.
Affects a lot more people than you'd think.
One in every
100 Americans per year.
One in 10.
One in 10 people are cast out of their body.
That's a lot of people.
So it was one in 100. Yeah, so I just thought that scene was so cool. I thought it was, like, I love that kind of thing. It was, like, so witchy and spooky and so, like, otherworldly and like, deep knowledge. Mm. You know, it was so cool. And he kind of doesn't know what to think.
No.
No.
Right?
Well, it was like when Charlie saw Grandma across the street, too. She was dead.
Yeah. So, and Charlie has also seen a cultist across that same street, and they're, like, waving at her all creepy. Because they're like, holy shit, this is a fucking demon king.
They're like, that's her.
You know, I feel like a celebrity. And he goes through. So, after trying to reach Joan and having no luck, she goes and looks through Ellen/Lee's boxes again. And kind of goes deeper, and that's when she makes all the connections. She finds the grimoires, the spell books, right? There's a blurb about King Paimon and how he might be summoned and
that
why.
He is covetous of a male body.
Yep, which is so funny. Like, why did they go for the female? It's pretty clearly laid out. Right. Maybe they didn't have that book the whole time.
Wait, do you mean? Why'd they go for the female?
Yeah, why'd they go for Charlie?
Oh, because she wasn't allowed to be around when Peter was born.
It says he can become, like, spiteful and vengeful if he's given a female body.
And I think he did, and that's probably why she was so fucked up.
Oh, yeah,
he was
totally.
Just, like, being petulant in there the whole time.
You just think that the cult wouldn't take that chance.
He didn't really.
Right?
Well, but I think that they hoped that she was going to be a boy, and then it was like, okay, we have to
this
for now.
This is the best we can do.
Until we can get to Peter somehow.
He's described as well as the god of mischief. We see a picture of Queen Lee, as she's referred to by the cult. She's in, like, a bride's outfit.
And getting coins sprinkled on her.
They're making it rain special coins on her, and she looks very happy. Also, pictures of Joan in there.
That just look like normal parties. Looks totally. Like a book club or
something.
The one
of her pointing at someone when she's serving cookies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it totally looks like it's just taken at your parents' party. And she's clearly close with Lee, Ellen. And also there's a picture of the cult kind of worshiping / you know, doing invocations around a picture of Annie's family on vacation.
Yes.
Right? And so she's kind of putting it all together. And that was just such a cool scene. I really love that kind of stuff. Almost microfiche in a library. Like, not
you
quite.
You guys love
next
that.
Best thing.
We love that so much.
I know why you love that.
Best thing, it's like they find something in the microfiche. They, like, slam the table and run out. And then the camera slowly zooms in on what it was.
On what it was.
Oh.
It was
the clue.
Oh, man.
That's a great trope.
Yeah, you telling me that the principal was the son of the person who was murdered 30 years ago? And then it's like, always has been. And I'll do it again. Okay. This is a scene I wanted to talk about too. Steve is sat on his computer. He's sat in front of his computer.
Yeah.
And he is and he's ready to send an email to a colleague who is a psychologist, a psychiatrist. And he's basically laying out, you know, it really pains me to send you this email, but I need to tell you about what's going on with my wife. So I had the impression he was kind of going towards potentially like a form two situation. Did you agree?
So that would be within our context of the legal framework
that's our context.
Of our province.
Right.
But you wouldn't go like colleague to colleague directly for that. He's perhaps seeking some advice.
You'd kind of go to the police, right?
The police are involved.
What's a form two, guys?
So I'll tell you what a form two is.
Yeah.
Just you wait.
We'll do form one and form two.
So under the Mental Health Act, there are a bunch of forms associated with it that offer like legal force to the medical proceedings around psychiatric illness, mental illness.
Especially admitting people against their will.
Okay.
Yeah, admitting people, treating people, controlling people's finances, yeah, this kind of thing. So in this case, a Form 2 is something enacted by a justice of the peace. And so it would be like, say you had a concern about mm-hmm. a family member or a loved one, and you spoke to them about it and said, I think you need to go to the hospital. And they say, no, I don't think I need to go to the hospital. I think I'm fine. But you're very concerned for their safety, their health. Then you could go to a justice of the peace, let them know what your concerns are.
Yeah.
For example, maybe they've been implying that they might kill themselves. So you go to the justice of the peace, you say, I'm worried about so-and-so. I think he might kill himself.
Yeah.
The justice of the, yeah, or hurt another person. And so then the justice of the peace issues a Form 2, which gives the police the force to go pick that person up against their will, bring them to the hospital. However, it does not enforce them staying in the hospital.
Right.
So once they arrive at hospital, a physician needs to issue what's called a Form 1, which keeps them in the hospital to be assessed by a psychiatrist.
And so it's like the Form 2 is someone in the community saying this person needs to go to the hospital and taking power to have that happen. And the Form 1 is like you presenting to the hospital, whether someone got you there or you got yourself there, and they're saying right now you're not allowed to leave because, you know, you're not in a mental state to do so.
And the way it usually plays out and the way I describe it to my patients is, okay, so you got seen by an ED doc. They're not a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
They say, this is not my expertise. I think you need to see a psychiatrist and be formally assessed. This is me making that happen.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that seemed to be what Steve was on to. He was setting something setting something in motion to get her assessed, to get her somewhere safe.
Something happening.
Finally. Yep. I mean, thank you, Steve. Exactly. Like, it's finally time that he's taking a step, but he gets interrupted because the insurance company sends him pictures of Ellen's dug up grave.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. From the cemetery, which was so long
as
ago.
As requested.
Now.
Here are the pictures.
And it was funny because, like, I guess that was letting the audience know, oh, her body was dug up. Like, someone didn't kick her headstone down. Like, someone took the body, right? Which is pretty cool. You know, along these lines, too, Annie has her attic visit because Steve was at work. She goes up to the attic, flies everywhere. Oh. Some of the characters have been commenting on the smell, too, in the house. And the flies are everywhere. She walks in. She enters the attic. She finds the decapitated body in white robes.
Her mother's headless,
which she assumes is her mom.
Bloated corpse.
Yep. And it's all black bloated, and disgusting. Blackened. And there are symbols, that same symbol from the necklaces painted on the walls in blood. And she's, again, convinced that that's the body of her mother. And again, like I said, scene, just cutting back and forth so much. The family's separated, so we keep checking in with them. And this is the scene in which Peter has the incident with his desk. So do you want to kind of describe that a little bit, Jenna?
So Peter is kind of like forced by some unseen entity into a really unnatural posture.
Yes.
Where his arm is stretched way up above his head and his hand is kind of flat at like a like perpendicular to his arm and pointing.
Yeah, and like turned up almost.
And his face is kind of in a weird snarl and it looks like he's not breathing. His face is going really red and purple. And so this is just something I'd like to speak about because this is obviously not a representation of the medical phenomenon I'm going to talk about, but it does bring it to mind. So people are often familiar with the term catatonia, which actually there's different kinds of catatonia and it kind of can present in different ways. Like there's akinetic, which is slowed or unmoving kind of movement changes, and malignant and excited. So excited refers to being like really restless and agitated, and malignant is accompanied by fever, tachycardia, and hypertension. There's those words we learned.
Nice. It all connects.
So catatonia is a neuropsychiatric syndrome characterized by abnormal movements, behaviors, and so that's what we're seeing here from Peter. And there is an aspect of it which is really interesting, which is if a person is experiencing catatonia, so if Steve, if you were experiencing catatonia and I picked up your arm by the wrist and I lifted it like this and made it and brought it to this position, it would stay that way when I leave my hand. It would just stay.
Interesting.
Weird.
And see, I would have, when I think of a person being catatonic, I think of them like still, you know, unreachable.
That's one kind.
So that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's one kind, but there's other kinds. And I remember it was actually one of my psychiatrists, I remember, sent me an email at a point in my career because I was saying like, talking to him, and he said, I think this person might be catatonic. And I said, I don't think so. They're moving all over the place and doing this. And he said, no, I think it might be excited catatonia. And I went, oh, I didn't. Like, that's not the kind that I'm familiar with. I'm thinking about just the kind where you're laying there not moving.
Right.
And he was like, no, actually, there's a few different kinds. And he sent me this, like, article about it. And I was like, oh, he thank said, you very much.
You foolish girl.
He said, oh, you idiot. What, are you some kind of idiot? He said... no, he was great.
Get for letting women be doctors.
He helped me out there, but it is very interesting. I have seen catatonia often enough, and it can be really significant. Like, I have seen instances in which a person had like thrush because they weren't moving. So it's like thrush is a candida, a yeast infection, a fungal infection. So it's like you would get them in places that don't get cleaned or moved around
or get access to air.
So like, for example, like some like women who are really heavy might get them like under their breasts, for example, but that's because they don't really move. They stay that way all day. Right. But I've seen people with it under their arms.
Wow. Yeah.
Which you move your arm.
Pretty interesting.
But it's because they weren't. Right. So it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is.
So in those states, again, you're not taking your medicine, you're not washing yourself, you're not.
Exactly. And then you wind up with, you got a different kind of infection. You've got skin breakdown. You've got, right? It all connects the body. Like, that's something that can be very frustrating working in psych, is that sometimes we get sent people from emergency department or whatever, and they've got some pretty serious medical problems at the same time. And I'm thinking, well, is it really most appropriate for them to be here or to be perhaps on a medical unit? But sometimes there's this debate on like, well, which takes precedence?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Here. Chicken or the egg kind of deal.
Yeah. And then it's kind of frustrating sometimes because it's like, sure, it might be because they're mentally ill, psychotic or depressed, but the fact is they need fluids. So you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or whatever. So
they still have a pressing injury that needs attending to, right? Yeah. Or a medical problem that's physical. That's interesting. And another example of how, mental health, mental illness can really contribute to a lot of other problems that are an indirect or a direct result, I suppose, but they're not, the chief diagnosis, right?
There are so many ways, right? Yeah. Like erratic driving.
Yeah.
Like there are so many ways that mental illness puts your health at risk in every way.
Yeah. So he has his arm up in the air. It's kind of pointed in the way of in the same shape as Payman's scepter in that picture, which is so cool.
And then he self-injuriously smashes his head, what, once or twice?
Twice.
Into the desk, bleeding. And then hard. He like
it was hard.
Screams and jumps back, which I thought was like some really excellent physical acting from Alex
he
Wolf.
He did great.
He looked, it didn't look silly. Something like that could have looked silly, and I didn't think it did, so... Kudos to him. I thought that looked really, really good.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying. He's just screaming. Yes. Everyone in his class is like backing
they're
up.
They're all like, ah.
They're like, ah. Oh my God, I can't imagine. They're all traumatized, I'm sure.
Exactly. And he misses the call to pick him up.
And
so
Steve
then it
goes
to pick Steve
him up. Yep.
And he picks him up. And as soon as Steve is like rounding the corner of their driveway, Annie rushes out and she's trying to tell him,
and
trying to talk to him. And he's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Right.
Peter's in the back with his nose in a splint.
And he's like unconscious. They drag him by his legs and arms and put him to bed and he doesn't rise. Yeah. He doesn't, wake up. So he's not doing very well.
Not doing too good.
Annie explains to Steve, hey, there's a dead body in the attic.
And he's like, oy vey, another thing.
Again, here we go.
And she even says, but that's not all. And he's like,
just
okay.
Wait, there's
he's
more.
Like, okay, so your decapitated mother's corpse is in our attic, but that's not all, really. Right?
And
he's
and
like,
I love it.
Why am I not surprised?
I love it when he goes up there because you don't see. Yeah, you just hear him go, ah.
It's like another one of those things with.
Like Annie
going out to the,
true.
To the
you're
station
right.
wagon.
But this was really interesting because Annie. Having all these realizations, and they're pretty hard to believe, and she's trying to rapidly explain them to her husband.
Pressured speech.
Yes, and Steve, this is something that triggered a memory of yours. You said you have a recurring dream.
Yeah, so one of my recurring dreams is screaming for help, and no one can hear you scream for help.
Yeah.
So she's going off on this wild tangent
of
things that are incredibly important, incredibly meaningful to her.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And important,
and he's just like barely even looking in her direction. And I'm like, oh, I know, like,
I know that feeling.
I know that feeling for my dream, because like you're screaming and you just want someone to listen, but there's nothing being reciprocated on the other end. So you're just
100%. That's a very
screaming at a wall.
It's very relevant to what's going on.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I actually have the dream of dreaming of being naked in places where I shouldn't be naked.
That one's yours.
That one sucks. You're like, oh no.
I used to get the teeth falling out, but I haven't had that one in quite some time. the teeth falling out was a weird one for a while.
That's wild for sure. The teeth falling out would be a pretty scary image, right? Also, she's trying to explain to Steve about Joan, and he's like, I've never met this Joan.
Yeah, saying like they're long-term, for like they've been friends. Oh, my friend Joan.
And he's like, I've never met her. I don't have any idea who this person is.
Yeah.
So she's trying to explain, look, there's a picture of Joan, but that means nothing to him.
Because she's been going to the movies, so she can't say anything about how she knows this person or...
Exactly. And you know what I thought was really interesting is when she was saying at the support group, you know, I realized that I'm blamed. You know, and she doesn't even know what she's talking about.
Right.
But now Steve thinks that she's done everything. He thinks that he even accuses her of having dug up Ellen's grave.
Yes.
He thinks that she drew the pictures of Peter dead in Charlie's notebook. He thinks that she has been doing all these things, and he's putting the blame on her, and she's reacting to what's really happening, but he can't see it.
Right. So her blame finally does come.
Yeah. Yeah. And he just thinks, okay, you're clearly, you know, having some kind of mental break that's going on, and you've been doing all this stuff and making it seem, you know, scary and all this stuff. And I know that it's really been you who's up to it. Right. So I just thought that was really interesting that she sowed the seeds for being the person who's blamed for the problems, and then it kind of does come to fruition that truly does happen.
That right? She's actually the, yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting. As Steve is checking out the attic, before we hear his little, oh, his holler, she runs down to light a fire in the fireplace, and he comes down. He's like, we need to call the police. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, there's your mother's body is in the attic, or a body is in the attic.
And she says, no, what we need to do, you need to throw this book into the fire.
Because I can't.
And you know what's interesting? She thinks that that will immolate her. She thinks that she'll die. She's saying, I'm too scared to do it, but I know it's what needs to happen basically to save everybody.
Yep.
So she thinks that she's going to die by fire when he throws it in. But Jenna, what actually happens when he refuses. He says, this won't help you.
Yes.
You know, you're sick.
He basically refuses to entertain what he believes to be her delusion. Which is an interesting line to walk when it comes to delusions, because as I've said before on the pod, you don't want to outright refute them because that can be really like jarring to the patient and also negatively affect your rapport with them. Mm-hmm. And it's generally not therapeutically helpful. But that said,
he's not her psychiatrist, right?
And also, if someone is saying something harmful, that's a delusion, you're not going to go along with that. Like if they say, I need to, you know, for example, I can fly. I'm going to jump off this building.
Good point.
You don't say, yeah, I think you could.
Yeah.
You say, I wouldn't try that.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? Obviously, you don't go along with it if it's harmful. So I'm not saying that it's wrong for him to say he's not going to do it. But obviously, within the context of this story, it's like, oh, come on.
He's pushed to his breaking point.
So she takes it out of his hand. She throws it into the fire. He bursts into flames. He goes up like a candlestick.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And it's heartbreaking, horrible. He goes up and he seems to be pretty quickly dispatched by this process. Yeah, very good indeed.
Yeah.
That he dies so quickly because it's a horrific image. And so she's horrified again, terrified, right. Horrified. She looks like it's the worst thing she's ever seen, and it is. And then very quickly this changes, light goes around.
So her the blue light drops. Goes on her and she goes slack.
She goes slack. She's possessed now. She ain't Annie no more.
Nope.
Yeah, exactly. And probably won't be again.
No, never is again.
Because we've got this scene here that I've labeled Peter's chase.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, Annie is gone.
Yeah,
There's no more Annie.
That's right. R.I.P. You kind of did a lot of bad stuff, but we understand you were under a lot of stress.
Sorry, Annie.
Maybe not all your fault.
Maybe no, it's certainly not all your fault. That's true.
We don't blame you.
No.
No, we don't blame you. We're just sad about a lot of stuff.
We're just disappointed.
We're not mad. Just disappointed.
Okay. Peter wakes up, and this was one of those scenes, right? The viewer can see, and it's slow. I think that, like, it starts darker and lightens up a bit. Peter wakes up from bed, and Annie is perched unnaturally.
Like a bug.
In the corner
like
of the ceiling.
Like a fly.
Yeah, exactly. So, Steve, I remember being like, do you see it? Do you see it?
And the first time, I still didn't.
Okay,
you hadn't given
really?
An indication yet that
no.
you had seen it.
I wasn't sure if you were just, like, staying quiet or if you really hadn't seen it yet.
We didn't know if you were, like, petrified.
No, because even the first time, like, did you see it? I'm doing a scan. I'm like, no. Then the second time, I did. So yeah. I was like, oh, that's even more scary because I did not see it the first time.
Right. Yeah. So she's perched kind of watching Peter.
Just right. like the unhuman movements and like,
100%.
Yeah. Oh yeah, she like crawls through the air.
Yeah. When he looks away, she basically swims in the air, or crawls, and disappears sideways. Like, that's another one that could look pretty silly and funny.
But you're already so spooked.
You're already scared.
Oh, are we ever?
Yeah.
We were all terrified.
This is the physical, the royal we.
We were all grabbing Jenna's leg because we were so scared.
This was
all
the,
three.
I needed someone there with me, guys.
This was the physical touch moment.
Yeah, it was bad.
You needed to like ground.
It was just so strange. It's like I needed something. It helps. Absolutely.
For sure.
I think that's some healthy coping.
Yeah, we approve.
Just like a clutch of someone else. Like, okay, there's someone else here with me.
It's not just
doing
me, right?
this. Yeah.
It helps.
So strange.
I know. And this was a really scary scene. I remember watching it in the theater and being like, oh my God, look there.
This
you know
is
what
so
I mean?
Scary. Oh yeah. In the super dark theater. Yeah. Very impactful.
Oh
very
yeah.
Because
it'd be huge in the theater. Yeah.
And the music's dark, overwhelming and everything, you know, like, oh geez.
So Peter walks through the house.
Starts to move down the hallway. Hey, is anyone there? We hear the big bang and the piano-y kind of ding sound. And then he goes downstairs.
He goes down the stairs, comes across his father's burned
charred
body. And something I had commented on when we were watching it, which is like forensically, medically accurate. The corpse has his arms up in front of him bent and his hands into fists.
Yes.
And that's something that naturally happens to bodies that are burned. And it's called boxer's pose.
Mm-hmm.
And it refers to the bending of the arms and the fists. And also like your legs would be similarly
is that
contracted.
Because like the tendons or something
your
tighten
muscle,
up?
They shrink.
Oh, right.
With like the heat.
Wow, that's so interesting.
And it makes everything bend.
Wow.
Fit like your fingers, your everything.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
He starts to freak out and we see again that Annie is again in the corner of the ceiling behind him watching him, but he doesn't see her, but he does turn around and he sees the smiley man from the funeral in the doorway.
Fucking naked.
And he's naked and white.
He doesn't even do anything. He just like stands there.
Smiles. And he's got those creepy fucking white teeth again.
Oh yeah, the big flippers.
Oh jeez.
Flipper like he's in a pageant.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden.
So that wasn't a ghost. That was a person
that was
in his house.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was a person.
Yeah. The actual human cultists are in the house.
Yeah. And they're kind of coming and going and messing with stuff, like moving little pieces around. And we hear a thump, and then Annie's not in the corner anymore. And suddenly, she just runs out of a dark corner of the room, and he just turns and runs. Yeah. Like, it's like kids playing chase. He is so scared and just runs, and she chases him.
And he runs upstairs.
To the attic,
runs
too.
Up to the attic, which, as Steve said that night.
Now, you never run up.
It's
never,
the worst place
ever,
you could be.
Never run up.
There's no escape.
What are you going to do?
And
just sit at the bottom and wait for you.
This is an image that stuck with me that I found really gross and scary. Yeah. You're hearing bang, 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 bang on the hatch of the attic.
Yeah.
Has to be a fist, you think?
Yes. And then it flips down and Annie is like on hands and knees, but on the ceiling and hammering her head against the attic hatch.
Yeah, that was very disturbing.
Ooh, that's scary. That was creepy as hell. And he's like, mommy, I'm sorry. Like just again, really reverting quite a bit, drooling. Like,
drooling a lot.
Excessively.
Yeah, you were a fan of that.
I was not. Get that guy some atropine. Am I right, medical professionals?
Oh, man, I bet they're rolling those medical professionals, probably laughing. So Peter also, when the banging stops, he takes in the scene in the attic. There's candles everywhere.
Yep.
There's a circle of candles around where the body had been, and there's an imprint of where the grandma's body had been, but it's gone.
Yeah, and there's like fluid there.
Yeah, I mean, it was there's some like gooey. Viscous, gnarly. Gross stuff, exactly. And there's a picture of Peter there with the eyes crossed out.
And right. He's like, and there's a cultist in there.
And there's, yeah, and there's three there. Naked grandparents stood there just looking at him, all smiling. Just watching him. Kind of like, almost like waving to him.
One of them does the wavy one. There's one who always waves.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, how does Annie get in there?
I don't think we see it.
She gets up there.
But all of a sudden, she's floating in the peak of the attic.
And,
and we hear...
garroting her head off with something.
He looks up and he sees her with the piano wire that she stole earlier, slowly garroting her head. And spurts of blood and everything. And then she picks up pace towards like... And
something spurs him to run.
I think that's when he sees the cultist, to be honest.
Yeah, he sees the cultist. That scares the shit out of him. And he runs out the window.
Runs out the window. And I think we're led to believe that Peter...
He's dead.
Peter's dead.
Peter the boy is dead.
He lands hard on the ground two floors below.
Yeah.
He's
and
dead.
And then a dark shadow moves away.
After we hear a thump, right? And the garroting stops.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Down goes her head.
Shadow floats over him. And we see the body kind of Annie kind of float up into the treehouse. The blue light goes on Peter.
On Peter's like back heart area.
And he starts to stand up and he is basically Charlie at that point.
He clucks.
He looks all disoriented and just kind of apathetic. You know, he looks kind of like we said with Charlie, she was always just at an arm's reach from whatever situation she was in. And that's the way he is now. And he ascends the ladder of the treehouse, and we get some really cool music at this point.
It's like
triumphant
music,
almost,
yeah.
Yes. And Joan welcomes him as Payman.
And there's right? a bunch of naked grandmas. Naked grandpas. Yeah.
There's a bunch of naked grandparents in the downward dog position, and they're worshiping, essentially, also the beheaded body of Ellen and Annie.
But, like, praying.
Yeah,
praying. Yeah, like genuflecting.
Genuflecting, yeah. And there's also a weird statue.
Yeah, it looks like the models that artists use.
Yes, it does.
To draw different body positions.
Remember the Robaxa set commercials?
Yeah, yeah.
Where they put a pin in it and they wouldn't be able to put straighten their back out. But it's also doing the weird finger thing. Like fingers pointed down.
And then it has a staff that's doing
it. And it
this.
Has
yeah.
Payman's
with the weird
scepter.
Hand, yeah.
And... it also has Charlie's dead head on it with a crown.
Yeah, looking pretty worse for wear.
Yeah. And so Joan welcomes Payman. She takes the crown from Charlie's head and puts it on his. And he's still kind of just like looking around, almost right. like he's confused
no
about
what's
where
happening.
He is, right? Yep. And I think you said it earlier, Jenna, yesterday, that he's like a fawn. Like he's like a baby almost because he doesn't belong in this world and he's kind of new to it and doesn't really know what's going on. But Joan says, welcome, Payman. One of the eight kings of hell. We've looked to the northwest, which is where the finger on the scepter is always pointing. We've looked to the northwest and called you in. And she says that they've gotten him the right body. You know, we've gotten you your male host. And she also says that we reject the Trinity and are completely devoted to him and asks him to bring them knowledge of all sacred things, forbidden knowledge, essentially, and wealth. And to bend men to their will. And then the final shot, we see the treehouse as like a disembodied room in
like
black space.
Yeah.
And again, it's like a diorama or like a dollhouse. And I just thought that was really a cool shot.
Yeah.
Right? And that is the end of the movie.
Whew.
Hail Payman!
Hail Payman!
There's a whole bunch of things I still want to talk about.
I know, but it only took us 3.5 hours.
That I know we won't have time for, but just like that.
3.5 hours plus, guys, I got to give you an inside.
Yeah.
John, for the second podcast in a row, did not hit record.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was 12 minutes.
It was only 12 minutes.
Yeah, 12 minutes.
We cut the fat. We got through it quicker.
Yeah, we
probably
did.
Got through it in six.
Yeah.
God, you'd think I'd have learned by now. But
rule one of making a podcast, make the podcast.
Hit record. Yeah, that's
make the podcast.
Just the heritability of mental health is a through line of this movie, and it is so fascinating the way that this movie is an allegory about mental health and the way that you inherit things from your parents and from generations before. Even there's a big sculpture of Annie's near one of the staircases, and it's like houses on top of each other.
Yeah.
And like descending vines. And so to me, I took that from like something starts in this generation, but it still has its kind roots of, it still has its roots in it.
Generational trauma.
Exactly. We could, maybe we'll do another episode or something to unpack this a bit, because there's so much mental health like, content.
Even
it's
the
amazing.
Term generational trauma is worth unpacking.
Exactly. And just about, you know, mental health being heritable, mental health being something you inherit, right? There's so many factors to it. So there's genetic component that's big, but also, but also your environment, your life experiences. But if you have like a traditional family where you're living with the people that you're born to, they also have a direct effect on those things too. You know, so I grew up in the house of a depressed person. It really affected my life. You know, I struggle with depression myself. Was it more the environment that I was in that played into that, or was it my genetic loading? It's fascinating. So
that's like, and that's people talk about nature and nurture. And I heard someone use a metaphor to describe how you can't separate the two.
Sure.
And said, that's like asking, is the music of a guitar coming from the strings or the picking? And it's like, well, it's both.
Right.
And it has to be both, and it will always be both.
You can't tease it out.
Yeah.
Right. So
there is no way.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even a, oh, well, you know, we're overthinking it. It's like, no, it's it. You, they're so enmeshed. You couldn't,
cannot.
Even, couldn't even start.
Cannot be.
So Ari Aster, who is quite a prevalent director, and this was his debut, his feature debut.
Which like is incredible, right?
And it's so well filmed.
Yeah.
It was shot.
It was.
Right?
Like the movie itself was very well done.
Crafted, right?
Maybe the content kind of irked me a little bit, but maybe. It was a very, very well done movie.
Maybe ease up on the spooky stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But he said he wanted to make a film about the corrosive effects of trauma on a family. Mm. And it's like, yeah, you nailed it, right? Corrosive is the word because they fell apart. Before this stuff came to fruition and they were killed by demons, you know, they were already just falling apart.
The demons were there the whole time.
Yeah, true that. I mean, it was very much by the demon's hand that it all happened. But the family was kind of self-cannibalizing because of the way they were dealing with the grief. And it's so interesting because it takes some cliches and turns them on their head. So there was a time after Babadook and stuff, some people were getting sick of the horror movie as an allegory for grief.
Right.
Or this and that. This one plays into that, but it was a big conspiracy theory put on by a cult. So there really was something like, oh, well, yes, that's there. We can read that content. And it was totally set up by these creepy people, you know? So I just think that's so cool. And he said it's a movie about suffering, which again, he nailed it for the viewer.
Yeah.
And it's a movie about people who are on rails and they can't change their fate. And just one last note, because I would like to take a chance maybe in a future episode to unpack some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is a movie about people who are preordained and predestined to suffer and all this stuff. There are allusions to how we can inherit some mental illness from our parents or, you know, a lot of things from our parents. But it wouldn't be right to say, you know, because your parents were mentally ill or struggled, that you're going to struggle in the same way or even get that same diagnosis. There are ways that the same diagnosis can be more severe and more mild, you know, so it's not so black and white as that. And we wouldn't want anyone to take that impression away.
And of course, it's not just mental illness. Many illnesses are heritable to different degrees, right?
Very good point. So I'm going to make sure I got all my questions to Steve here. So Steve, a few takeaways. What are your feelings towards Annie now that you've seen the whole film through?
Now that I've seen the whole thing.
Yeah.
I think she certainly tried. Like you said, her subconsciously, she could tell something was wrong with the family. And she was really, it seemed like trying her best to steer them to not inherit whatever was coming down the pipe, whatever.
Exactly.
She knew that her mom was strange and aloof and a little bit different. And she was trying to be a good mom. You could see that there were moments where
she wanted to be one.
Where she wanted.
It was just not in the cards.
No.
Yeah, you're right.
No, she just couldn't. I don't know. Maybe. But it worked fine up until those, what was Charlie, 12, 13?
Yeah, they made it a long way.
So like she got 12, 13.
And she had some good instincts, like she eventually decided to keep Ellen away.
Right.
Although, you know, that was partially Steve's idea. What about towards Steve? What are your feelings towards the father?
So I was saying when we were watching the movie that it's always the mom that breaks down.
The Babadook, yeah, it's a good parallel.
It's never the dad that breaks down because, John, as you said, well, it's a lot scarier for the mom who's usually the one that has to hold it all together to break down. So.
And be maybe the more nurturing one sometimes. And I'm talking about stereotypes.
Yes.
But yeah, more caring, more soft.
As
you know?
A stereotype, the beating heart of the family unit.
You're right.
Mom, right?
Yeah. So what do you... So,
and then poor Steve there who's just trying again for his... to keep some resemblance of normal.
Yeah.
To try to keep them
right.
on the track, like asking about the SATs a week after his, he was involved with the death of his sister. Like, he's just trying to keep the train moving.
You're right. And you know what? That's a compassionate look. And I think that that's a well-informed take. I have some, I think, unfair anger at Steve.
Seen the movie a lot more times and been able to dig into it a bit more than I have.
I think that your take is more well-informed. I think for me, I'm wishing he would have done something to stop it. But I think your take is more well-informed that like he was trying to do it the best that he could. And he was trying to honor his responsibility to Annie and his responsibility to his kids. And so, I think you really, I agree with you. And also, he's a human man.
Yeah,
and
more compassionate. His family was and dead. Is to
his
to
family
have some
was dead. Like he deserves more grace than for some reason.
Yeah,
unless he was completely calling it off with Annie. Like, how do you tiptoe that line of?
And where do you leave Annie?
As everybody does, right? You try to make everybody happy, but when it's
and he was
a
spread
son
thin.
And a wife, like that's a
no. You're right, and I think that, like I said, I think my feelings of anger towards Steve are unfair. I have mixed feelings. I'm upset by what happened to me. When I watched this movie.
Oh, this whole movie was very uncomfortable, man. Like, it's just, they're all very well done.
Yeah, we have been showing you some cream of the crop.
We've been cherry picking for sure.
Yeah, because I, from listening to you guys speak about other horror movies, there's some real cheesers out there.
And, oh, and, definitely.
And you guys are giving me some...
We're giving you some of the high quality primo stuff.
Yeah, get the real good stuff.
What do you find tougher to watch in this movie? Is it the family grief stuff or is it like the over the top supernatural ghost is coming to kill you kind of thing?
It was the ghost stuff that really got me. It did.
It was scary.
It is scary.
The mom up in the corner, scary. Like the cultists, all that kind of
creepy
stuff.
Creepy naked grandma.
It was a very creepy movie. It was a very creepy movie. It's the family stuff that I keep thinking about. Thankfully, it's not the floating mom that I'm just like, oh man, that was really weird.
Thank goodness for you.
Yeah,
because you you happen to have a great relationship with your parents. So
yeah, we get along. we get along great.
As do we. But I could see if you came from a challenged family of origin background, this
you might
would
not want to watch it at all.
Tough watch.
I don't have to worry about my mom haunting me too much. The normal amount of haunting.
Yeah, like the normal, like calling you and...
Did anybody come up with the word for not awake when it's after the funeral yet? Because I've been trying this
Is it the reception? Is it the... It's not the after party then? That's not,
I think reception is appropriate because that just kind of means
no,
when you're
be
receiving
a stupid
people
word
for
food.
No, that's when I said like that's when you need the DJ and it's like introducing for the first time as a widow, Mrs.
For the first time as an orphan.
Mrs. Williams, and then like everyone has to come out and do some stupid dance as they're introduced,
First time as a widow.
See all the guys just.
Yeah, exactly.
They do shot.
Funeral crashing.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'll go to Steve first. Any final takeaways from this movie and what was your experience like?
Now that I finally watched it, knowing that it was coming.
Yeah.
It was a very, very well done movie. I know you guys were saying that it was snubbed on a lot of the Oscar fronts and people felt like it maybe should have been.
That's my opinion.
But it was a very, very good movie. It was very scary on multiple fronts, not just And like I was told, it's not like jump scare scary.
Not
it's,
at all. Yeah, you're right.
It's going to make you think, screw you up for a long time kind of scary.
Yeah.
And it was good.
Good.
It was
hard, but it was good.
It was hard, but it was good. It was definitely an experience. I'm glad I got to watch it with you guys who are more than great to watch these scary movies with.
Plus, we went and got a nice meal first.
We did. Made a night guys, of it. I got wined and dined. It was incredible. It was a great experience getting to watch this movie with you guys. I always enjoy whenever you ask me to do them, and I'm game for whatever kind of horror movie that you want to throw in my direction. It's nice, like I said before, being able to have a curated horror movie selections for me. It's very nice. It's not a lot of people have that, so
we'll have to do a Halloween one.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah,
that'd be great. It's not too far away, Halloween.
I know. It's on my mind.
Okay, and Jenna, any final thoughts for us?
My final takeaway would be watch it. And if you've watched it, watch it again, because it's very rich, lots and lots of details.
It's rich. And watch that five-hour breakdown, and we will link the name of that YouTuber. Because there is enough content in this movie to just unpack it, and it's also well-researched. And I just want to talk about the mental health stuff all day long.
We're like four hours. This is going to be two episodes, because we're 4 hours in.
So, listeners, we would like to thank you so much for joining us. As usual, we really value you guys joining us for these. And, you know, for anyone who has the time, has the will to give us a rating, that really helps to get this podcast out there.
Please
for people.
Rate, review, send us an email. We really do appreciate it. And
send us an email because we love reading them.
Send us an email. We really enjoy reading them. Absolutely, we do. And also, to rate and review helps the algorithm get us out there a bit.
I did notice your rating's up on Spotify, so that means you must have hit the threshold.
Yay.
Wow. Yeah. That is all thanks to you guys listening. So we appreciate you so, so much.
Yes, thanks. Take care, everyone, and we'll see you at the next one.
Like Jamie Lee Curtis.
I'm old.